At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Behind the Black, 15 years of Behind the Black. Your subscriptions, your donations, your generosity, most appreciated. As Bob and I are very happy all these years to celebrate Bob's success, but you make it possible. So I thank you as Bob thanks you. However, we got work to do today. Elon Musk is on the prowl. No more of this government stuff. He's back driving the bus, many buses. Bob, a very good evening to you. It's exciting to have Musk back in action. I was beginning, well, I never really worried, but I thought, how long will this last? What do we know about the 10th Starship?
Yes, the 10th orbital test flight of Starship Super Heavy, according to Elon Musk, is going to occur in about 3 weeks. He put out a tweet earlier this week that stated very little. It just basically said, launching again in about 3 weeks. As we all know, Elon time is usually very accelerated, so 3 weeks might be 4 or 5, but this gives us a launch window, approximately, of getting this off the ground. I'm not sure how they're going to do it. They have to get their test stands for doing static fire, pre-launch static fire tests of Starship rebuilt after the explosion in June, which destroyed the prototype they were going to launch. But it's very clear that the design of this whole system is smart. They have an assembly line of prototypes ready to go. So when one blows up, they can immediately move the next one in line into place. And that's essentially what they're doing. I mean, the explosion in June has caused at least a month delay, at least 2 months probably. But it's still, they're moving forward pretty fast. So that's where we stand now, John. We'll find out more details about what they intend to do, I think, in the next week or so as they move closer to launch day.
Manufacturing in space. What does that mean for Starship, Bob?
Oh, this is a fascinating news. You might remember earlier this week, the capsule company Varda raised $187 million in investment capital, bringing their total cash to almost more than $300 million. And what Varda does is it sends up a capsule for a period of time, which then it recovers. And while it's in space, it uses the capsule to, in weightlessness, manufacture products that you can't do in gravity, most important of which are pharmaceuticals. We've known this for more than 3 decades, that there's money to be made on pharmaceuticals that can be produced in weightlessness that you can't do on Earth. Well, it appears that SpaceX, as a company, noticed that big investment capital to Varda, because this week they revealed, there was a news story that revealed they are exploring the possibility of using Starship for manufacturing in space. The same idea. Now, Starship is a lot bigger than Varda's capsules. Varda's capsules are small. You pretty much couldn't put a person in one of them. They're small. You know, they don't need a lot of bulk to do pharmaceuticals. But Starship would be gigantic and give you a lot of options. So they're exploring this possibility. The news story, it's all based on anonymous sources, so we have to consider this a little bit uncertain. The sources say that they're looking at the idea of launching a series of small capsules within Starship, which would be deployed and then come home when needed. And there's reasons to think that makes sense. There's also reason to think it doesn't. You know, let Starship work it within its giant payload bay, a lot of stuff. But either way, SpaceX is looking into this because there's money to be made here. And if they get Starship working, they have a capability to take advantage of this. So once again, the real market in space, the profitability, the future exploration is now beginning to pay off, John. That's the exciting thing.
Bob, do I read this correctly? The Hatfields and McCoys have made a deal with each other?
Yes. Well, this was done actually about 2 years ago. Amazon is trying to put up its Kuiper constellation of satellites to provide internet globally. It's a direct competitor with Starlink by SpaceX. When Amazon signed launch contracts to get those satellites into orbit, it signed contracts with ULA, with Blue Origin, and with Arianespace. It excluded SpaceX. And I guess you could say that some logic to that, because SpaceX is a direct competitor with Starlink. But from a stockholder's perspective at Amazon, it makes no sense, because SpaceX Falcon 9 is a cheaper and more reliable rocket. The other three rockets haven't really launched yet. They haven't become really operational. And so Amazon was bidding its whole constellation on using rockets that hadn't flown yet. And so the stockholders sued. Amazon realized, we have to protect ourselves, the board of directors. So they signed a contract with SpaceX for three launches. SpaceX has consistently had a policy. It says no to no one. If they want a rocket launch and they're willing to pay, SpaceX is glad to be the launch provider, even if it's with a direct competitor. And so they signed the contract. And this week, SpaceX successfully launched the first 24 Kuiper satellites. It was its first launch for Amazon. Amazon's now done three launches. It's gotten about 124 satellites into orbit, a little less than that, a little more than that. I don't remember the exact number. They have to get 1,600 into orbit by July of next year. So they're under pressure to do this. So there are lots of rumors suggesting that because of the slow operations of ULA, Blue Origin, and Arianespace, a lot of the launches to those companies might be transferred over to SpaceX to get them up. And that's an interesting thing. Either way, Amazon is moving forward and SpaceX is providing the capability.
And any comment from ULA?
No comments from any of those other companies. What can they say? ULA seems to be getting close to ramping up the Vulcan rocket that it has, the new rocket to replace its older rockets. And so I think ULA is going to start to produce launches by the second half of this year at some rate. It won't match SpaceX, but they'll begin to do it. What's happening with New Glenn and Arianespace, that's another story entirely.
Axiom is building a space station. That's the idea. But they're turning into the Expedia of low Earth orbit. What have they done?
Yeah, well this last week, earlier this week, their fourth tourist mission to ISS returned to Earth. And there had been speculation that the ticket price they were charging was $70 million. But according to India, which launched one of the three passengers, the price they paid for the Axiom mission was $59 million. I'm doing some math. If that's what the Hungary and Poland paid, that means they brought in about $177 million in revenue, Axiom. They have to pay SpaceX for the launch. That's about $70 million. And they're probably going to have to pay some money for the use of the Grace Dragon capsule. We don't know what that is, though. And, of course, NASA charges something like $10 million plus to spend 2 weeks on ISS. Those are now government milking private enterprise. Either way, it looks like Maxim came away with a profit from this mission of somewhere between, I think, $20 to $50 million. And that's good money that they can use to build their space station, John.
New Space Force, space policy. Is this a good thing? It looks it.
It is a good thing, I think, overall. But, of course, you know, it's a bureaucracy, so one should always be careful, never trust anything that they do or say. But the Space Force has instituted a new space policy, and they published an addendum to that. They use this silly word annex that the bureaucracy has suddenly come up with for addendums. They call it an annex. But it's called the Principles for Space Access Resourcing Decisions. These are basically nine basic principles they want to use for their space policy. And what struck me about all of them is they're really focused on encouraging private space to give the military a lot of redundancy and options in what it needs to do in space. That's really the focus, which is really good. It's capitalism in space. This is a really idea. It talked at great length about the launch rates that are increasing at Cape Canaveral and Vandenberg. These are military launch ranges that the military runs and controls. And they talk about how this is increasing costs, and they need to work with the private sector to deal with that fact. And what the principle suggests is that negotiations should go on between the companies that are launching and the Space Force to deal with the increased costs, which I think is actually the right way to do it. The military should figure out the right amount to charge in a competitive market for their services. This is a much better plan than Ted Cruz's tax plan, which would create legally required fees from every launch provider that would go up with time. And that's a blunt and not very flexible way to handle this. Let the Space Force be a business in this sense and charge what makes sense for the for its launch facilities. That's what the principles say. So overall, I would say this is a good thing, John.
Bob, when Axiom has its own space station, does that come under government regulation?
Well, the government will always want it that way. It's an interesting question. The regulations as they even now presently exist would limit the FAA as the launch license provider and the FCC as the radio license provider for communications. But other than that, they should be free to do what they want based on the present law. As indicated by Ted Cruz, Congress will very quickly see, oh, we can steal money from these guys if we pass new taxes and laws, and they're making money. We got to have a we got to get our cut. And so that could very well happen. But right now, they'd be pretty free to operate as they wish.
It suddenly occurred to me that we could be looking at a tariff-free zone here. You know.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly the in the long run. Yes, that eventually will be the case. And that will, of course, generate governments worldwide to say, oh, no, no, we want our cut. They got a nice business there. It'd be a shame if something happened to it. And so I'd expect governments to move in unless we can change our governments.
We're writing a science fiction novel here. OK, we're just getting the terms of villainy. All right. Russia recognizing that commercial satellite constellations are what?
A threat. Russia this week informed regulators that the International Telecommunications Union, this is equivalent to the International FCC, that it now considers all European and American commercial satellite constellations, quote, legitimate targets to be destroyed, close quote, if they provide any help to the Ukraine. They said that their first action is they're going to be jamming them. And that involves GPS, it involves broadcast satellites, it involves communication satellites like Starlink and OneWeb. They are willing to jam and damage them, but they're saying very clearly they are targets that they could also destroy. And remember, Russia does have anti-satellite technology. The kind they have is they move a satellite close to yours and blow it up. They have these capabilities. Whether they will actually start destroying actual commercial satellites from other nations is another story. But don't be surprised if a lot of these satellite systems start getting jammed in extensive ways.
I think it's unusual to give the warning before you actually demonstrate what you can do. But all right, SES and Intel status, is old news?
It's all the new news. We've been talking about this merger where SES, that's a Luxembourg satellite company, would be buying Intelsat. That's a European and American satellite company to merge the two companies. These are old companies that have been launching geosynchronous satellites for decades. Intelsat's one of the very first. It first formed in the 1960s as a consortium of 23 nations worldwide to put up geosynchronous satellites. They are merging, and this reason is an old story, is because the regulatory process makes a merger like this very complicated. You've got to get a lot of approvals, and I've reported on the various approvals over time. But they've now completed the merger. The two companies are now one, and it's basically SES. The reason these mergers are happening is because of the low-orbit constellations that are coming on from Starlink, OneWeb, and now Kuiper. They're providing a service that's stealing the business from the geosynchronous satellites, and they're merging in an attempt to try to survive. That's essentially it.
And a new launch platform for the ESA. Where?
Yes, there are actually two. I've reported on another one, but this is a second launch platform that would be docked in Europe, but would launch rockets in the North Sea between Great Britain and Europe. And this company is called Eurospace. They have signed an agreement. They've gotten an okay and some funding from the European Space Agency now, and they've signed a contract with a Polish suborbital rocket startup called Space Forest to do a launch sometime in 26 off the platform. It would be a suborbital launch, mainly a demonstrator that to show that this platform is good. There is a second company in Europe called Offshore Space Force Alliance that wants to launch out of its platform out of Germany, Bremen in Germany. So we've got launch platforms in the North Sea, John, as well as spaceports north of that in the Norwegian Sea. It's getting interesting, John.
And South Korea is in the game. What do they want?
Yes, they formed a space agency last year, and there was questions, that space agency, is it going to be encouraging private space, or is it going to set up a space program? And I, based on everything they said, they were going to do private enterprise, but based on everything they were doing, I said, nope, they're going to do a space program, they're going to control everything. Well, they just announced this week that the Korean Aerospace Administration, CASA, is creating a space program roadmap over the next 15-some-odd years, or 20 years, actually. Where by 2045, they hope to have a lunar base and Mars missions, both landers and orbiters. This is their plan, and it includes other things as well, sun research and planetary other missions. But it's a space program. It is not. It is focused on they run everything, they're going to dictate everything, and they're going to use that to try to encourage a space industry. I don't think it's the best way to do it, but they're in the game. They want to be a player.
Bob Zimmerman, 15 years behind the black. When we come back, a joyous new mystery. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.